All right, so tonight I'd like to talk about thought as relationship to meditation and how we can hold it in a different way than we perhaps have ever learned it in our lives, in our schooling, in our training, or how our parents taught us, but actually a really radical different way of holding thought. So the class so far is really focused on body sensation and sound, the breath, the sensations that are arising in the body, even emotions as body sensations. And this is intentional because it's very helpful to learn this contact with the body to help us ground in the present moment. Because the body is always oriented there. It's always here in this moment. It's really our minds that take us out into the future. So it helps us orient to the present moment and have that sense of grounding here. Because otherwise, it's easy for thought to take us into the past, into the future, into patterns of worry, into fantasy, planning, remembering. We all have our hit parade of thinking that we often rely upon. And it's not to say that thought doesn't have its important role in our life. Everything that we see in our environment was based with someone's thought, and they're able to skillfully turn that into reality, through manufacturing and all that stuff. But we're talking about this unbalance we have, or this bias we have toward the thinking mind versus really being present and really feeling the body. And so it's learning to kind of reorient our relationship to thought, and at the same time bring this wealth of information that the body offers. So usually we do live lost in a world of thought. There's a character from James Joyce's Dubliners, Mr. Duffy. And there's this phrase I love that Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And I think we can relate to this when we walk or drive someplace and don't even realize how we got there. We just suddenly arrive. We go on autopilot because we're lost in a fantasy or a thought process trying to figure something out. So learning to reconnect is learning how to find our body. And in doing so, we're learning to find the present moment, which has always been back here waiting for us. So the sequence of these instructions, again, if we started with thought on day one, I think we'll find that we are like walking into a fast-moving stream, and before we know it, we're swept down the current. And thought has that momentum and that almost magnetic quality of pulling us in. Because we spend so much of our time in thought, we're just like it's a very natural place to go. And as many of us commented upon, thought also has it's a two-edged sword. And sometimes we have thoughts we just wish we could turn off and not keep going, the ones of obsessive worry and anxiety, of planning and repacking over and over again. This is the power that thought has if we're not conscious to it. And so the class began with learning, okay, where is sound and where is the body? So it's like we're almost standing on the bank of that river and noticing when my foot goes into the water and when it comes back on the solid earth. When I'm connected with a body sensation, and when am I lost from thought? So for most of the class until tonight, when thought arose, the instructions were to notice thought is here and come back to what's present. Come back to the body. Come back to this sensation of the breath. Come back to sound. Of course, thought is another thing that's present in the moment, but it has that power of sweeping us away. So first we have to really distinguish between the direct experience of the moment versus our thoughts or our elaborations around that moment. What's the difference between a breath and the idea of the breath? What's the difference between a sensation and the thoughts behind that sensation? And then tonight we expanded the instructions to include thinking itself, and again in a fairly particular way at this point. To first recognize, observe thought itself, just like another object of awareness. Thinking is here. And to actually observe it a little bit more closely instead of before you release it, to recognize its process, its presence, to label it as thinking, and even to focus in a general way, what type of thinking is it? You know, is it planning, worry, fantasy, memory? And this step isn't, you know, always necessary, or perhaps may not be the right step for you. Just noticing thinking and just observing it is fine. With thoughts that tend to be very engaging, stepping back and noting, oh my, I'm planning right now, helps us kind of wake up from the spell of the thought. Because observing, labeling thought means the place of observation is stepped back. We've gained a sense of perspective. We're no longer lost in the middle of that thought. We actually know that we're thinking. We actually know that thinking is arising, which means we're starting to observe it, thinking objectively. We're not so lost in it. Okay, this is actually kind of a really significant step, because so much of our own identity, our sense of who we are, who the world is through the vehicle of thought. And to radically step back and notice, oh, thinking is arising, we're actually experientially noticing that there's a different thing that's paying attention here. We start to realize that maybe thought and my idea of the world, the idea of me even, isn't the whole story. If I can observe it, maybe it's not such a statement of reality. So observing thought starts to open up a very fundamentally different relationship to thinking. Because usually we take it as being so substantial, as being a statement of truth, a reality. I am this way. You are that way. This is how it is. This is that. This is whatever it might be. And to step back and say, oh, that's thought. That's thought. That's just thinking. I don't know if you can get a sense how radically that can change how you are in your life. Because if we don't have that perspective, thought is really driving us. It's like it's what's pulling us along. It's like when I take my dog on a walk, when he sometimes really wants to sniff, sometimes it's more like he's taking me for a walk versus the other way around. There's a story that kind of speaks to this, and how we can have an experience and we create a story around it, and that story becomes our reality. And we don't realize that we were the ones who created the story in the first place, and yet we go around acting like that's true. You know, and this is really the seeds of so much of our difficulty as human beings. How we create a story, you know, through prejudice, through discrimination, you know, how that gets behind society power and becomes racism, for example. This is all a story that we've created and built upon. This story is from Sharon Salzberg, who's a really very senior teacher in this tradition, one of the first Westerners to go to Asia and learn these practices and bring it back. She's particularly well known for her work around loving kindness and metta. So she was teaching, I'll read the story, she was teaching with her colleague, Joseph Goldstein, when a student came to see him in great distress. The man said he just had a terrible experience. He was meditating, felt tension in his jaw, and suddenly realized what an uptight person he is, how he can't get close to anyone, and that he's going to be alone for the rest of his life. Joseph said, "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" The man continued with his projections. He said that he was pretty sure he'd always be tense. He would never change. He felt hopeless. "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. I watched the man continue barreling down this path of misery for some time, all because of a sore jaw, until finally Joseph said, "You're having a painful experience. Why are you adding a horrible self-image to it?" Right? This really succinctly sums up much of our suffering, much of that added on suffering. And that's really the big part of the practice, if not the whole part of the practice, is learning that added on suffering is optional. That we see how we experience pain. We all experience pain. But when we create this story around it through our relationship to thought, we amplify our suffering. We say, oh, this is how I am. I'm always going to be a terrible person, a lonely person. This is all added on suffering. The good news is it's added on means it can be subtracted. So this is the power of thought. It can clearly create literally who we are, who we take ourselves to be. And we're driven by it. We're really victims to it. So meditation, this radical sense of starting to relate to thought, just as another experience, starts to kind of cool down our addiction to thought, our unconscious relationship to thought. And having wish I could give you all a bumper sticker that said, don't believe everything that you think. You know, just don't believe everything that you think. If you get that out of the class would have been well worth it. Because this starts to free us up from being chained to our thinking. You know, and this, just in terms of thinking as a tool, this is incredibly beneficial to be able to look at a problem from different sides to see, here's my bias, here's my orientation, what's a completely different way? We can't do that if we're held to our thought. And especially what holds us to a particular thought is our investment in the story, what it means about us. I'm so smart around this, or I'm so charged around this, so worried about it. So we start to see thought can be a tool that we pick up when we need to, but it's not the end story, and it is sometimes not the right tool for the job. We always can learn whole thought in perspective. So this is, I hope you get a sense of how this particular night, thought in relation, learning to meet thought, can drastically change your meditation and change your life, because you're not unconsciously relating to thought as reality. That's why it's, I don't know if I've emphasized it in this class, but sometimes I do, that this isn't a breath meditation. The breath is an access to connect, to steady our attention. But ultimately, when you want to look at this whole array of being human, this whole gestalt. Now, it's interesting, in Buddhist psychology and teaching, there's actually considered six senses. Okay, so there's the normal five senses of, you know, sight and smell and et cetera. And the sixth sense, it's not like a, you know, supernatural sense that we often think of. The Buddha basically talked about thought as another sense door, another sense organ. The mind is another sense organ. Now, just let that sink in for a second, that the way the Buddha looked at experience, he didn't say, there's all these senses, you know, smelling and sensing and hearing and seeing and tasting. And then there's this other really important thing called thinking. He said, thinking is equal and should be related to in the same way as a breath, as a sound, as a sight. That's kind of radical when you think about it. And that's how completely inverse of how we think about it. Everything has to go through the mind, through our concept, for us to interpret it, to understand it, to figure it out, to judge it, to have more of it, to get less of it. And so, I mean, from a meditative standpoint, we're starting to hold thought as equal as other experiences. So keep that in mind as you're practicing. Can I hold my thinking mind like I would hold my breath? How does I hold a sensation or a sound? And this is actually a very helpful way of approaching the difficult. Because often when the difficult arises, we become kind of tunnel vision around it. Everything kind of closes down except for that one worry, that one pattern, that one insult, that one remorse. Everything else falls away. You kind of had a quality of concentration that's more neurotically driven. Now, in the midst of that, if you can step back and notice, okay, my mind's really caught in this, can I also feel my feet? Can I also feel this breath? Can I also, I love to do this in nature, can I also, my worried mind's caught in churning and gnawing on this problem, but can I have an equal relationship, equal amount of awareness to that bird singing or that beautiful cedar tree waving in the breeze. If you start to do that, suddenly you actually go back into mindfulness instead of that locking in on one object. So often we do notice that our moment by moment, it's almost like a seesaw. We're either on our breath or we're lost in thought. There's kind of like not much of a middle ground. It's kind of like boom or boom. We're either sensing or we're thinking. And we start to think and our senses become dull, maybe we're forgotten, and take a back seat. Because we're wired as human beings to focus on thought. And we really start to notice this as you meditate. And I don't know if you had this expectation that, you know, when I sit down, I'll be able to just turn off my thoughts. And you actually realize how much the thought just keeps going and going. Or some of us may have realized how much my mind's thinking. There's no way I can quiet it down. And perhaps we're surprised by the space between the thoughts. It's actually not a continuous stream of thought. There's actually thoughts, and then I can connect with my breath for a little bit and then go back. So we do spend much of our time thinking. So that's also why I emphasize that gentleness of coming back. Because if we get judgmental around it, that's just another thought. It's another thought that's laced with self-hatred, self-criticism, which just makes a level of tension. So just reflect on how much time you do spend lost in thought and learning to come back. Now, developmentally as a meditator, as your practice matures over the years, you start to find there's this interesting shift that your mind tends to default toward preferring silence. Okay, so right now, our minds tend to prefer thinking. It's like that's the natural state of mind, the default. But learning to practice, especially as we start to see life clearly, as the insights arise, we see things, our perspective changes in a fundamental way, our mind starts to incline toward the quiet. So we're just not doing anything and our mind is naturally more quiet. That internal narrative starts to soften, even to cease for a while. And as thoughts arise, they're able to be seen. Oh, this is a thought arising. You know, sometimes there's thoughts which are unconsciously just gripping us, but we wake up to those sooner, more quickly, and easier to let go of. Now, thinking also has this more subtle level, this deeper, unconscious quality, these unexamined beliefs and assumptions about the world, which really define us and define how we experience everything, really. The Buddha talked about it in this interesting way that he said that we create the whole world through this phantom long body, this 6 foot or 5 foot long body. And what he meant by that is not like we're some kind of super powerful natural creature that creates the world, but really the very way we perceive the world is created through our minds and through our sense data. Sense data arises, we interpret it, and we create the interpretation of the world. And we're constantly kind of having to readjust that as the world says, no, it's not quite right. So an example of this and how subtle this can be is around language. Because, you know, we each have, you know, our native tongue that we were born into and how we learn to see the world. And that in itself has a certain conditioning, a certain programming that allows us to perceive the world in a certain way. So there's this, I read this story about this bridge in France that was, when it was built, it was one of the longest or biggest bridges in the world. And it spanned a river that was, one side was Germany and one side was France. Now the French would look at this beautiful new bridge, and they would describe it as being powerful and strong and massive. While the Germans would look at the exact same steel and concrete and say, oh, it's elegant, it's graceful, it's beautiful. Okay, so why such a big difference from one side of the river to the other? And as if you look at the language, the way that bridge is defined, or it's a the gender in France, in French, I should say, is masculine, while in German, bridge is feminine. Okay, just that simple conditioning, that simple way of viewing the world through, how your parents taught you and your culture taught you, changes how you actually experience the world. And you can see such a radical difference. So, it may not seem like a radical difference, but if you take that little example and expand it out to when you see someone who, you think is other than you, that's different than you, someone that you distrust through your own prejudice, through your discrimination, all those qualities of racism, if that's part of your, your as a white person having that inherent racism. That quality, as that arises, that's part of this whole mechanism. And it's still thought. And the more unconscious it is, the more powerful it has. And it's learning to recognize it, to wake up to the fact, how am I painting my projection on the world? It not only liberates yourself, but also liberates the world from your mind. This is very significant, that so much hardship. How much harm is caused by our projections, by us not understanding another person? A more perhaps simple way of experiencing it is next time you go outside and see a tree, notice the idea of tree, the label in your mind of tree. This is a tree. Perhaps you even know it's a cedar tree or a Douglas fir or a big leaf maple or whatever name you might have, or the sense of liking or not liking it. Maybe it's a tree that you like to hang out in during the summer, or maybe you have to prune it, or maybe you don't like it because it drops pollen on you, or whatever it might be. All these associations that come up with that tree. That's all what the mind is projecting on that tree. Now see if you can see underneath that to the direct, immediate experience of that tree. Letting go of your ideas around it. Like if you've never experienced it before, if you had no preconceptions to this tree, how would you experience it? And you may find as you do this, that suddenly that tree, it's like it almost rushes into you because you're not holding it apart with your projection, with your idea. When you release that, suddenly the tree is felt in its essence. And you realize that essence, you can't describe it fully or adequately with words. You might capture an essence through poetry or some quality of it, but it's very different than the actual experience. Okay, what I just described is really the art of meditation. It's learning to feel a sensation in that way, an emotion. To learn to see another human being in that same way. The projections may come through, by recognizing this thought, you can see through that and actually make contact with who that person actually is, who you actually are. So you start to see that there's a freedom that comes from that. There's a sense of potentiality to live life. With life, meeting life how it is, not through how we think it should be. So, how to work with thought? So, first, to ground, know the difference between being lost in thought and being connected to something that's present right here, like the body, a sound, a breath. Okay, so it's first we practice releasing thought, connecting back. And when I say at first, that may mean, any time in a meditation, even if you've been meditating for 10 or 20 or 30 years, maybe a time your mind is just active. Okay, not to judge that, but just recognize that's the state of the mind. Okay, I need a ground. I need to steady my attention. And then also recognizing when the mind is more steady, it's naturally more oriented to what's here. Okay, then you can start to notice thoughts arising and passing away, just as we did in this meditation. Right? So you have to, some thoughts have a stronger pull, so you have to kind of find your ground to be able to observe them. Some thoughts are more ethereal or more whimsical or more light, and it's easy to kind of see them as they're arising. And some thoughts, because they're gripping, you can actually say, okay, in the body, where is this located? Where is this sense of worry or planning or fantasy? How is it echoing in the body? Another way of working with thought is pausing and acknowledging, what am I taking as being true? You know, what's my underlying premise in this moment? So this example, I may have used already, but I'll use it again. Let's say you're taking a walk in the woods and you see a coil of rope in the distance, but it's kind of dusk. And so maybe it's not a coil of rope. Maybe it's actually a snake. That snake, and the thought goes, oh, if that's a snake, what if it bites me? And if it bites me, maybe I won't be able to get care in time. I might lose my leg. If I lose my leg, then so you start to get more anxious. Maybe I will lose my job, or my partner will leave me, and I'll be, you know, home on the road to homelessness, all because of this snake bite that was imagined and misinterpreted as a coil, you know, from a coil of rope. And so what am I taking as true? Okay, there's a snake or a coil of rope. You kind of come back to that core piece and look a little more closely. So thought has this incredible power, you know, to create, to discover, to plan. It can also have a tremendous power for obsession, oppression, illness, anxiety, and worry. And so learning to see it just as another experience that's arising and passing away, like the breath, like a sensation, like sound. We start to become free to use the thoughts well, and also not be driven by them, to release them, and to let the world rush in and be met by us. All right, if you could just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle.